Last Sunday night, I did a special festival on the dating game to show the unreliability of the way in which they conclude the millions of years in the fossils in the area around Lake Rudolph, now Lake Turkana, where the Leakeys have done their anthropological work. And I want that 2.5-hour festival put right into the Roman series as though it's a Sunday morning message, as a supplement to last Sunday's message. Is that clear? I want what I'm going to do now, a supplement to today's message. Is that clear? Many times I've referred to the work of Michael J. Bay, entitled Darwin's Black Box. Other phrases are the ghost in the machine. Drives hard-head evolutionists crazy because they have no answer for it. It's like the missing link. It doesn't exist. They're always talking about missing links. They've been looking for them ever since Darwin wrote his Origin of Species. They haven't found one yet. Not one. Archaeopteryx turned out to be a dud. And next Sunday, I'll read from some that are putting in the category of the Piltdown man is a fraud. Not the animal, but the feathers. That ought to be interesting as I show you either next Sunday or the following. They have never found a missing link. They have no explanation when it was apparent that the fossils would not justify evolution. They thought that molecular biology and the study of the genes and DNA and RNA would provide another front on which they could prove evolution. More than any other field of study has proven it wrong. Intelligent design is built in the genes. A program is there for the impossible. They're just like all of creation, only more eloquently called for a designer. A computer cannot accomplish anything without a program. I said I referenced this morning blood clotting, something common to species more than man, but in every case, it couldn't happen by chance over a long time. Chance says mutations occur. That's a small change, so slight it normally can't be seen, and then more slight changes, and more slight changes, like the bombardier beetle who blows himself up for 1,000 years, and then develops an inhibitor in another 1,000 years, and then sits as an inhibited explosion for another 100,000 years. And gets eaten, and all the predators get is mouths full of inhibited gas until he figures out how to get the tailpipes and the anti-inhibitor and blast in the face of a predator 212 degrees Fahrenheit. That's boiling water. Odious gas. And all the parts had to be there for it to work. Be like evolving a mousetrap, a platform, and a spring. What can a platform and a spring do? And the odds of each part of it, even a mousetrap, if it were an organism, it'd be challenge the brain toward idiocy to think it would evolve these parts. And then all of a sudden, hey, I got them all, let's use them. The kinds of things I'm going to talk about, you had to have them all there in the beginning. The whole program had to be worked out exactly. For example, he entitles this Rube Goldberg in the Blood. The name of Rube Goldberg, the great cartoonist who entertained America with his silly machines, cartoons of machines of entertaining habit, well, this will be one of them, lives on in our culture, although the man himself has pretty much faded from view. How many of you even know who I'm talking about? Few. I was introduced to the notion of a Rube Goldberg machine as a kid watching Saturday morning cartoons. My favorite cartoon was the Bugs Bunny show, and I always enjoyed the loud-mouth rooster, Foghorn Leghorn. I remember a number of episodes in which Foghorn Leghorn would be stuck babysitting some smart young chicken with thick glasses while his widowed mother, usually rich, went shopping. At some point, Foghorn would annoy the youngster, who would then plot his revenge. A brief scene would show the perturbed chick scribbling some equations on a piece of paper. This got across just how smart he was. After all, you have to be pretty smart to scribble equations. And was an omen that the revenge would be exacted in a precise, scientific way. A scene or two later, Foghorn would be walking along, notice a dollar bill or some other bait on the ground and pick it up. The dollar was tied by a string to a stick that was propped against a ball. When the dollar bill was moved, the attached string pulled down the stick. The ball would start to roll away as Foghorn stared slack-jawed at the developing action. The ball then would fall off a cliff onto the raised end of a seesaw, smacking it down and sending a rock with an attached piece of sandpaper hurling into the air. On its upward journey, the sandpaper would strike a match sticking out of the cliff, which lit the fuse to a cannon. The cannon would fire. On its downward track, the cannonball would hit the rim of a funnel, the only allowance for error in the whole scenario, roll around the edge a few times, and fall through. As it came out of the funnel, the cannonball would hit against a lever that started a circular saw. And of course, the funnel for the cannonball was so it could hit at an angle and then slowly change its direction. As it came out of the funnel, the cannonball would hit against a lever that started a circular saw. The saw would cut through a rope, which was holding up a telephone pole. Slowly, the telephone pole would begin to fall, and too late, Foghorn Leghorn would realize that the fascinating show was at his expense. As he turns to run, the very tip of the telephone pole smacks him on the head and drives him like a peg into the ground. Smart kid. When you think about it for a moment, you realize that the Rube Goldberg machine is irreducibly complex. That's the point. No way in which that combination of events could occur by chance. It takes a planner. When Charles Darwin was climbing the rocks of the Galapagos Islands, pursuing the finches that would eventually bear his name, he must have cut his finger occasionally or scraped a knee. young adventurer that he was, he probably paid no attention to the little stream of blood trickling out. Pain was a fact of life to the intrepid island explorer, and it had to be borne patiently if any work were to get done. Take some of the bass out of my mic up there. Eventually, the blood would have stopped flowing, and the cut would have healed. If Darwin noticed, it would not have done him much good to speculate about what was going on. He didn't have enough information to even guess at the underlying mechanism of clot formation. The discovery of the structure of molecules of life lay more than a century in the future, and I would add to disprove his theory. Darwin was an intellectual giant and a great innovator, but no one can guess the future, especially in its critical details. Blood behaves in a peculiar way. When a container of liquid, like a carton of milk, or a tank truck filled with gasoline, springs a leak, the fluid drains out. The rate of flow can depend on the thickness of the liquid. For example, maple syrup will leak more slowly than alcohol, but eventually it all comes out. No active process resists it. In contrast, when a person suffers a cut, it ordinarily bleeds for only a short time before a clot stops the flow. The clot eventually hardens and the cut heals over. Blood clot formation seems so familiar to us that most people don't give it much thought. Biochemical investigation has shown that blood clotting is very complex, intricately woven, a system consisting of a score of interdependent protein parts, like foghorns, complex machine that led up by the little chicks planning to him being hit on the head and turned into a peg. The absence of or significant defects in any one of those parts in the chick's plan, the telephone pole wouldn't have fell. Any one of the number of components defective or absent, the system fails. Blood does not clot at the proper time or at the proper place. It's a task that leaves little room for error. Over the next few pages, as I read it, you'll meet the score of protein players in the game of blood clotting. Interested? Learn a bit about their roles. Like members of a sports team, some of the players have strange names. Don't worry if the names or the roles of the protein quickly slip your mind. I would add, scientists have to do this occasionally to just add a little flavor to the detailed, tedious research work. The purpose of the discussion is not for you to memorize trivia. Rather, my purpose is to help you get a feel for the complexity, and I would add irreducible complexity, which means it cannot have happened by chance, one part at a time, developing by evolution. My purpose is to help you get a feel for the complexity of blood clotting and determine if it could have possibly arisen step by step, as evolution says. About 2 to 3% of the protein is blood plasma. The part that's left after the red blood cells are removed. That 2%, which is the protein in blood plasma, consists of a protein complex called fibrinogen. You're not supposed to have to remember the names. You're going to just notice that part of the name gets cut off. The name fibrinogen is easy to remember because the protein makes fibers that form the clot. Yet fibrinogen is only the potential clot material. Like the telephone pole before it is felled in the story about Foghorn Leghorn, fibrinogen is a weapon waiting to be unleashed. Almost all of the other proteins involved in blood clotting or blood clotting control the timing and placement of the clot, as the other things in Foghorn Leghorn control the falling of the pole. Anyway, he said that. This, too, is similar to our cartoon example. All components except the telephone pole were required to control the pole's fall. Fibrinogen is a composite of six protein chains containing twin pairs of three different proteins. Electron microscopy has shown that fibrinogen is a rod-shaped molecule with two round bumps on each end of the rod and a single round bump in the middle. So fibrinogen resembles a set of barbells with an extra set of weights in the middle of the bar. Remember, it's like the telephone pole. Normally, fibrinogen is dissolved in plasma, like salt is dissolved in ocean water. It floats around, peacefully minding its own business, until a cut or injury causes bleeding. Then another protein, called thrombin, slices off several pieces from two of the three pairs of protein chains in fibrinogen. The trimmed protein, now called fibrin, because it's been reduced by the cutting process, which is done by the protein thrombin when a cut occurs and blood starts to flow. The trimmed protein, called fibrin, has sticky patches exposed on its surface that had been covered by the pieces that were cut off. So a protein named thrombin prepares fibrinogen by cutting part of it off, leaving sticky patches that have been covered. The sticky patches are precisely complementary to portions of other fibrin molecules. The complementary shapes allow large numbers of fibrins to aggregate with each other to form a random glob. Now, that's referencing another thing that he used, the tubulin tuna cans. Let me read it again. The complementary shapes allow large numbers of fibrins to aggregate with each other. However, neither do fibrins stick randomly, because the shape of the fibrin molecule, long threads form, cross over each other, and much as a fisherman's net traps fish, make a pretty protein meshwork that entraps blood cells. Here's a drawing of it. Enough. Okay, you lost already, but I think you're getting the idea that it's got a lot of parts to it and everything is perfectly synchronized. This meshwork of these fibers that stick together and form, using the sticky patches to combine with other fibrins, because this isn't just one that happens when the threat comes and the cut occurs, form a sort of fish-like net. And it entraps blood cells. This is the initial clot, as I just showed you in the picture. The meshwork covers a large area with a minimum of protein. If it simply formed a lump, much more protein would be required to clog up an area. Thrombin, which cuts off the pieces from fibrinogen, is like the circular saw from the Foghorn Leghorn cartoon. Like the saw, thrombin sets in motion the final step of a controlled process. But what if the circular saw ran continuously without needing the other steps to turn it on? In that case, the saw would immediately have cut the rope holding up the telephone pole well before Foghorn moseyed into the vicinity. Follow that? It had to be turned on at exactly the right moment. Similarly, if the only proteins involved in blood coagulation were thrombin and fibrinogen, the process would be uncontrolled. Thrombin would quickly clip all of the fibrinogen to make fibrin. A massive clot would form throughout the animal's circulatory system, solidifying it. Unlike cartoon characters, real animals would rapidly perish. To avoid such an unhappy ending, an organism must control the activity of the thrombin that cuts the fibrinogen and starts the clotting process. The body commonly stores enzymes, proteins that catalyze a chemical reaction or cause it to start, like the cleavage of fibrinogen, in an inactive form for later use. The inactive forms are called proenzymes. When a signal is received that a certain enzyme is needed, the corresponding proenzyme is activated to give the mature enzyme. As with the conversion of fibrinogen to fibrin, proenzymes are often activated by cutting off a piece of the proenzyme that is blocking a critical area. That strategy is commonly used with digestive enzymes. Large quantities can be stored as inactive proenzymes, then quickly activated when the next good meal comes along. Thrombin initially exists as the inactive form, prothrombin, just as fibrin existed as fibrinogen. Thrombin, which cuts the fibrinogen, initially exists as the inactive form, prothrombin. Because it is inactive, prothrombin, like the saw, can't cleave fibrinogen, and the animal is saved from death by massive inappropriate clotting. Still, the dilemma of control remains. If the cartoon saw were inactivated, the telephone pole would not fall at the wrong time. If nothing switches on the saw, however, then it would never cut the rope, and the pole wouldn't fall at the right time. If fibrinogen and prothrombin were the only proteins in the blood clotting pathway, again, our animal would be in bad shape. When the animal was cut, prothrombin would just float helplessly by and pass the fibrinogen as the animal bled to death. Because prothrombin cannot cut or cleave fibrinogen to fiber or fibrin, something is needed to activate prothrombin. We're working backwards now. Perhaps the reader can see why the blood clotting system is called a cascade, a system where one component activates another component, which activates a third component, and so on. Since things are beginning to get complicated, it would help a lot to keep track of the discussion with figure 4-3. I don't think it would help you. I'll keep reading. A protein called Stewart factor cleaves prothrombin, turning it into active thrombin that can then cleave fibrinogen to fibrin to form the net that captures the blood into a blood clot. Unfortunately, as you may have guessed, if Stewart factor, prothrombin, and fibrinogen were the only blood clotting proteins, then Stewart factor would rapidly trigger the cascade, congealing all of the blood in the organism, and the organism would die. So Stewart factor also exists in an inactive form that must first be activated. Am I boring you? At this point, there's a little twist to our developing chicken and the egg scenario. Even activated Stewart factor can't turn on prothrombin. Stewart factor and prothrombin can be mixed in a test tube for longer than it would take a large animal to bleed to death without any noticeable production of thrombin. It turns out that another protein called acelerin is needed to increase the activity of Stewart factor. the dynamic duo, Accelerin and activated Stuart factor, cleave or cut prothrombin fast enough to do the bleeding animal some good. So in this step, we need two separate proteins to activate one proenzyme. Up till now, it's been one to one to one. Now we got a double fail-safe plan, getting ready to pull the trigger for the nuclear warfare. You got to have more than one person or enzyme involved. Yes, as you guessed, Accelerin also initially exists in an inactive form called Pro-Accelerin, Psi. And what activates it? Thrombin. But thrombin, as we've seen, is further down the regulatory cascade than Pro-Accelerin. So thrombin regulating the production of Accelerin is like having the granddaughter regulate the production of the grandmother. You want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
We're not done. It's station break time, so you can get on the phone and tell me to continue or not.
Joining us, this is Dr. Gene Scott's program, which is already in progress. Dr. Gene Scott on the University Network. Call in on this program at 1-800-338-3030. Million callers can now use 1-800-338-3030. Visit Dr. Scott on the Internet at www.drgenescott.com. Once again, Dr. Scott's website is www.drgenescott.com.
We shall get by.
to continue now. Back up just a little in case somebody slipped in. No more calls in case somebody slipped by on the network or turned the radio on. Blood clotting is a complicated process. Fibrinogen must be cleaved to expose sticky patches that enable fibrous connections to form a fishnet-like fibrous series of connections that the blood clots into. But it can only be activated with thrombin. And thrombin is a result of cleaving, and it can only be activated by the Stuart factor, which is the result of cleaving, which can only be activated when it's cleaved. And at this point, there's a little twist. Even activated, the Stuart factor can't turn on prothrombin, can't cleave it. They can be mixed in a test tube. Nothing happens fast enough to clot blood. Another protein called accelerin is needed to increase the activity of the Stuart factor. And the only thing that you or I have to remember out of this complicated, detailed analysis is how many steps and how impossible for evolution to produce this irreducible complex action that operates with precision and saves the life of all of us at various times in our life, how all of it could just evolve by chance. A failsafe is built in. You're cleaving fibrinogen to fibers. You're cleaving prothrombin to thrombin. You're cleaving Stuart factor. And a Stuart factor suddenly adds back in the chain a double whammy, failsafe. Even activated, Stuart factor can't turn on prothrombin. Stuart factor and prothrombin can be mixed in a test tube and not cause the result. Turns out another protein called accelerin is needed to increase the activity of the Stuart factor. That duo, accelerin and activated Stuart factor, cleave or cut prothrombin fast enough to do the bleeding animal some good. So in this step, we need two separate proteins to activate one proenzyme, the Stuart factor. Yet, accelerin, one of the two that's needed to cleave the Stuart factor, exists in an inactive form called proaccelerin. What activates it? Thrombin. But thrombin, as we've seen, is further down the regulatory cascade than proaccelerin. So thrombin regulating the production of accelerin is like having the granddaughter regulate production of the grandmother. And that's where we were. Nonetheless, due to a very low rate of cleavage of prothrombin by Stuart factor, it seems there is always a trace of thrombin in the bloodstream. Blood clotting is therefore anticholytic because proteins in the cascade accelerate the production of more of the same proteins. We need to back up a little at this point because, as it turns out, prothrombin, as it is initially made by the cell, cannot or can't be transformed into thrombin even in the presence of activated Stuart factor and accelerin. Prothrombin, and now it gets complicated, but you're going to see that's the point, how complicated it is. Prothrombin must first be modified by having 10 specific, now it really has complexity, by having 10 specific amino acid residues called glutamate residues changed to Y carboxglutamate residues, in code they have GLU or GLA, the modification can be compared to placing a lower jaw onto the upper jaw of a skull. The completed structure can bite and hang on to the bitten object without the lower jaw, but the skull can't hang on. In the case of prothrombin, Y-carboxyglutamate, GLA, residues bite or bind calcium, allowing prothrombin to stick to the surface of the cells. Only the intact modified calcium prothrombin complex bound to a cell membrane can be cleaved by activated Stuart factor and accelerin to give thrombin. Now, if you understood that, go to medical school. But I understand this. It got increasingly complicated. And we're working backwards. These are the first steps that are made. The last step is fibrinogen is cleaved and the fibers begin to form. We're working back up the chain. And it's getting increasingly complicated because to start the process, these complicated actions protect against clotting in your whole body, activating at the wrong time. The modification of the prothrombin does not happen by accident. Like virtually all biochemical reactions, it requires catalysis by specific enzyme. In addition to the enzyme, however, the conversion of glue to GLA, the two different kinds, needs another component, vitamin K. Vitamin K is not a protein. Rather, it is a small molecule, like the 11-cis retinol that he's described earlier, necessary for vision, which is another one of his complicated descriptions in this book of the complex organism that we take for granted that can't happen by chance, of sight. Like a gun that needs bullets, the enzyme that changes glue to GLA needs vitamin K to work. One type of rat poison is based on the role that vitamin K plays in blood coagulation. The synthetic poison called warfarin for the Wisconsin Alumni Research Fund, which receives a cut of the profits from its sale, was made to look like vitamin K to the enzyme that uses it. In the presence of warfarin, the enzyme is unable to modify prothrombin. When rats eat poison food or eat food poisoned with warfarin, prothrombin is neither modified nor cleaved, and the poisoned animals bleed to death. That's how critical this vitamin K is. And the synthetic that looks like it and fools the enzyme that uses it results in death, bleeding to death. But it still seems we haven't made much progress. Now we have to go back and ask what activates the Stuart factor. It turns out that it can be activated by two different routes called the intrinsic and the extrinsic pathways. In the intrinsic pathway, all the proteins required for clotting are contained in the blood plasma. In the extrinsic pathway, some clotting proteins occur on cells. Let's first examine the intrinsic pathway. And they want me to go back to the figure that's more complicated than the words. When an animal is cut, a protein called the Hageman factor sticks to the surface of cells near the wound. You remember that movie? And the name just slipped me. It's a movie that I can't. It won awards, and I wouldn't go see it because it has such a silly name. It's the one where the woman gets turned on when somebody talks Italian to her. A fish called Wanda. So she had this boyfriend to turn her on. She didn't know he was Italian. He'd turn her on and say, ravioli, spaghetti, linguine. Well, man, if you're the kind to get turned on with scientific terms, you're into a treasure trove right here. Hageman factor, Stuart factor, Googla. Stuart factor, fibrinogen, prothrombin, accelerin, proaccelerin, and when an animal is cut, a protein called Hageman factor sticks to the surface of cells near the wound. Bound Hageman factor is then cleaved. Boy, there's a lot of cutting going on to fix your cut. By a protein called HMK to yield activated Hageman factor. I wonder why they don't have a pro-Hageman factor. Immediately, the activated Hageman factor converts another protein called prekallikrein. Well, they're even using killer terms now. Prekallikrein, I guess. P-R-E-K-A-L-L-I-K-R-E-I-N. Prekallikrein is the way I pronounce it, but I don't know. To its active form, kallikrein. Now, see, they're still throwing. These scientists just love to confuse. Why not call it prokallikrein instead of prekallikrein? And why not call prethrombin? Now, pro normally means the prototype, previous. This is pre-type, whatever that means. Anyway, there's something called prekallikrein, and it's a protein called HMK activates the Hageman factor, which converts another protein called prekallikrein to its active form, kallikrein. Kallikrein helps HMK speed up the conversion of more Hageman factors to its activated form. Activated Hageman factor and HMK then together transform another protein called PTA. Parent-Teachers Association going on. To its active form. Activated PTA, in turn, together with the activated form of another protein, discussed below, called convertin. Now we've got an evangelist in here. Switch a protein called Christmas factor. Tell me that isn't an evangelist. Christmas factor to its active form. Finally, activated Christmas factor together with anti-hemophilic factor, which is itself activated by thrombin in a manner similar to that of proaccelerin, changes Stuart factor to its active form. There you got it. Like the intrinsic pathway, the extrinsic pathway is also a cascade. The extrinsic pathway begins when a protein called proconvertin is turned into convertin. I'm going to use that. Every person I preach to is a pro-convertin. The extrinsic pathway begins when a protein called pro-convertin is turned into convertin by activated Hageman factor and thrombin in the presence of another protein, tissue factor. Convertin changes Stuart factor to its active form. Tissue factor, however, only appears on the outside of cells that are usually not in contact with blood. Therefore, only when an injury brings tissue into contact with blood will the extrinsic pathway be initiated. A cut plays a role similar to that of foghorn leghorn picking up the dollar. It is the initiating event, something outside of the cascade mechanism itself. The extrinsic and intrinsic pathways cross over at several points. Hageman factor activated with the intrinsic pathway can switch on proconvertin of the extrinsic pathway. Convertin can then feed back into the intrinsic pathway to help activated PTA activate Christmas factor. Thrombin itself can trigger both branches of the clotting cascade by activating anti-hemophilic factor, which is required to help activated Christmas factor and the conversion of Stuart factor to its active form, and also by activating proconvertin. Flogging through a description of blood clotting system makes a fellow yearn for the simplicity of a cartoon Rube Goldberg machine. By chance, folks, Darwin himself said, if there's anything that can be discovered that could not have evolved step by step, his whole theory is destroyed. They've discovered them in spades. But evolution keeps going on. Fossils are the substance of things hoped for. And missing links, the evidence of things not seen. It isn't there. There are no missing links. Evolution is a clock. Microevolution within species can be demonstrated. Finches' beaks change when the weather changes, and those with long beaks, the only food that's available requires in the dry weather a strong, long beak, so they survive and reproduce what's in their genes. And when the weather changes, where the smaller beak is necessary, they change back again. It's oscillating. There's not a gradual evolution from large beak to small beak and permanent. It's in the genes, within the species. That simple little truth, that when the genes, half from the father and half from the mother, intertwine in the hundreds of thousands of options that are there, which means no two of us look alike. But there's no gene bank that will somehow match a couple somewhere where the recessive genes bring forth a chimpanzee or a half and a half. It doesn't happen. Never did, never will. If the Bible's true, the gene pool started with Adam and Eve. And all the genetic traits, the mutations went down. I've often explained extrasensory perception as a throwback in recessive genes to traits that were common to Adam and Eve made in the image of God. In the genes of all of us, recessive, there are traits that go back to the magnificent creation, Adam and Eve. Adam from the dust of the earth, and God breathed into him a special quality, a part of himself, and man became a living soul. And the word soul in the English is used for both animals and Adam. It's a different word in the Hebrew. Adam got something unique. And in those traits, given the rare combination of recessive genes covered by mutations which always deteriorate, do not improve, with only the rarest of exception, were less than what they were. This program for blood clotting was built in by a programmer. It didn't evolve. It's a fine-tooled watch, no part of which can vary, as the universe. If there was a Big Bang, which is open to question, there was a figure that would fill this room with zeros. If any part of it, just take one temperature, had varied a degree that would require zeros around this room to show the lack of margin of deviation, there'd be no life on this earth. I'll bet most of you have never thought Adam wasn't created an embryo. He wasn't created a 5-year-old boy. God didn't put a newborn babe in a garden and tell him to work it. He was created a full-grown man with all the parts working. And Eve, a full-grown woman with all the parts working. And they were told to replenish the earth. Literally fill the earth. Replenish it full. Well, until they sinned, they were going to live forever, so I guess they could take on that task. And it wasn't until later that childbirth became such a pain. Did you ever pay any attention to art? Pictures of Adam and Eve, were they sure with a belly button? Who was the mother that tube was connected to? He came out of Adam's rib. Wonder what would have God if he'd given a leg for it? The point I'm making is God could create the universe at any fixed stage. You could just speak, and there it would be perfectly synchronized. And if you wanted to, you could create it, including the earth, with fossils intact and background noise that's supposed to be the echo from the Big Bang. All of which to test these scientists whether they would become morons or recognize his grandeur. If there's a creator, and no limits on him, how he does it. Likewise, I distinguish myself from strict creationists. I do not quarrel with the possibility of a long age for the sun, the universe, and the earth. I just quarrel with their dating methods and their lying ways of saying that these dating methods are accurate and prove anything. They don't prove anything. They just suggest some things. And I object to their ruling out a designer when the whole creation, from the smallest to the largest, the more you explore it, the more you have to say, how great thou art. Now, get on the telephone.